Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Здравствуйте, товарищи, и добро пожаловать в Star Power. I'm Roberto.
And I'm Brendan, and together we're ranking the Russian rulers from Rurik to Putin. Roberto, who are we ranking this week?
This week, ruler number 12, Sviatoslav II.
What, another one? Are you kidding me?
We got another Sviatoslav. He's the first number two.
No, I think we've had a lot of number twos before this. We've definitely had really shit rulers.
I'm thinking they've just been bad rulers.
What, no reaction on the number two pun?
Oh, I just got it.
I had to explain it to you.
I still laugh. It's okay.
Yeah. Oh, we talk, we laugh.
It's a fine time.
I don't know
time.
Why I did that accent.
I don't either.
Anyway.
But before we jump into today's episode, we want to give thanks to quite a few new patrons who have joined our ranks. We have Hal the Legionnaire, who will now be dubbed Prince Hal of Polotsk, head boat wheeler for Oleg the Seer. And we also have Duke Quinn of Viborg, the director of the Academy of Science, also of Noblesse Oblige fame. And we also have Duke Emily of Novosibirsk, patron of the Hermitage Museum. Thank you all for your support.
Thank you very much.
And we're going to tell you about another Rexy pod that we like, and one of them that also supports us, called Ranking 76. Ranking 76 takes a look at the figures from the Wild West, so for me, it's great to learn about a place I have no clue aside from Texas, and here they are with more info.
I'm Eric.
And I'm Matt.
And together we are Ranking 76, so we are interrupting your normally scheduled podcast just to talk about...
The Wild West, a cold, dangerous, merciless place, a place of lawlessness and violence. Join us on our adventure as we take you through the trials and sacrifices the settlers and Native Americans took to shape the...
Dear God, man, are you okay? That hurt my throat.
I'm okay.
Okay, well, while Matt's recovering, I'm just gonna take an opportunity to tell you that we review and rank the heroes and villains of the American West, and then divide them up on our own individual teams, and then at the end, we're gonna face them off in each other to see who can build the best team in the West. And Matt, have you recovered?
Join us!
Okay, back to your regular show, everyone.
I've really enjoyed listening to their podcast, and Matt and Eric are amazing people. I've met Eric in person and currently play D&D with Matt, and they're both amazingly hilarious and super interested in showing more history about the Wild West. The most Tsar Power-like figure is probably John Wesley Hardin, but my personal favorites are probably Tecumseh and Chief Joseph. Check them out. Because, you know, we need some American history.
Yeah, I think there's one thing our listeners are deprived of. It's probably American history. Let's be real.
Absolutely.
Whether or not they're living it. Because,
yeah,
I don't know. I think I just nearly lived through a major tornado, so I don't know.
Yeah, we had someone's door just get blasted off here. Like, they opened their door. My neighbors. Yeah, like, they opened their door. Like, it's like a double door thing, but they opened the outside door, and it just got blown off its hinges. So, I was like, wow, that sucks. Glad it's not me.
Well, you know, a good neighbor would offer to help them fix it.
I can't fix doors.
You can hold a screwdriver.
Yeah, but I barely know the guys. Well, before, now we're getting off track. And what do you remember from Siaslav the Sorcerer's episode?
You know what? I think this is one ruler who I could literally not forget. Quite literally, I could not ever forget anything about this quite remarkable ruler. I recall that I believe his father was a snake.
Yes.
Yeah. His father was a snake. He was born with a caul on his head, which indicated he had some sort of magic power. And he had a habit of turning into a wolf or a snake, I think, also. A wolf.
A wolf, a snake, and a bird. And an elk. Yeah. Auroch, whatever they're called.
Auroch.
Yeah.
Well, an elk and an auroch are very different animals, I have to tell.
What is an auroch, anyways?
An auroch is an extinct relative of the cow. Or the buffalo or the bison. They basically look like gigantic cows.
Well then, I wish I knew that because I thought it was just a big elk. Oh,
they're long extinct, but there is a guy who was trying to sort of breed them back into existence by basically breeding enormous bulls, just the biggest bulls they can possibly find.
Interesting. Well, what else do you remember?
He was not a ruler for very long. He was only a ruler for a couple months before he was thrown out again. I get the feeling that the chroniclers did not like him all that much.
No, they really didn't. They were like, oh no, he got arrested and thrown in prison, even though his cousin said, we're not going to arrest you after kissing the cross. And then they put him in prison anyways. And then after that, they're like, no, he's the worst. He's a devil.
Couldn't he just teleport out of prison?
You know, he teleports all the time, but never teleports himself out of prison. Yeah, maybe he was wise enough and like that he knew that they're going to make him the Grand Prince, which is why he didn't leave. He said to bide his time. You never know. Well, anyways, he was very uninteresting and we sent him to the gulag.
Yeah, it's just like he is such like an interesting character. Interesting figure in the literature, the historical literature, that is. Mm-hmm. And I say literature rather than history because, you know, this didn't happen. But in the literature, he's just quite a strange figure. But in the end, he was just still kind of boring.
Yeah, and we get that. And I'm just like, I wish he wasn't because he has the best epithet so far.
Yeah, the sorcerer. The spookiest epithet. We should have done a Halloween episode on him, but whatever.
We did Baba Yaga. It's okay.
Well, yeah, but we could save him for the next Halloween episode.
We read everything he's in, so everything's out already.
All right, then.
Well, let's move whatever. On. So, you know, usually this is when we cover the etymology of the name, but we've covered Sviatoslav before because he's number two, baby.
Yep.
Alrighty. Are you ready to get into it?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Brendan, let's begin. Sviatoslav Yaroslavich was born in 1027 AD to Yaroslav the Wise and his beloved wife Ingegerd of Sweden. He was baptized as Nicholas, and once he was old enough, around 1040, Yaroslav gave him the territory of Vladimir to control. It was around this time that he married a woman named Kilikia and had a daughter named Vyacheslava and four sons named Gleb, Oleg, David, and Roman. For the sake of not repeating this later, because it's not that important, Vyacheslava marries Duke Boleslav II or Duke Boleslav the Bold of Poland. And then much later, he marries a woman named Oda of Stade around 1065. But we're not going to really mention this too much because it's not going to be very important. She gives him a fifth son whose name is Yaroslav. And he becomes a prince of Murom and Chernigov. But that's not important to the story. Around 1054, when Yaroslav the Wise passed from this world to the next, he gave the territory of Chernigov to Sviatoslav and asked him to listen to his older brother, Izyaslav, the now Grand Prince of Kiev. The three brothers formed the triumvirate and decided to share power together. However, we can see quite a discrepancy here, because Izyaslav, as we saw from previous episodes, was not the best of rulers. He was indecisive, he couldn't plan for the future, and was prone to fits of rage. On the other hand, our man today, Sviatoslav, was quoted as being brilliant on the battlefield, in politics, and always wanted to inspire culture in his realm, as we will see. So I'm setting him up for some good stuff right now, aren't I?
Yeah, I can see. Well, you know, imperfect people are always more interesting.
Well,
imperfect men, you could say.
That's another Rexypod, which we will recommend at some other time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, with Chernigov now in Sviatoslav's possession, he set to work. He started building up the city because it had not been given much attention since his uncle, Mstislav, who died in Yaroslav's episode during a hunting accident, quotation marks, was in charge of the city. He organized the local government and introduced symbols of identification for his territory, which is something you'll see common with the Rurikids. They'll have like insignias for, you know, who they are. So like the one you see normally for like Ukraine, that typically tends to be like Vladimir or Yaroslav.
Ah, okay. I think I know what the one you're talking about. That's interesting. I didn't know that.
So they all had different ones for each other. And then these same symbols were used to mark his soldiers along, you know, with the banners that they hold up, and everything of his territory mm-hmm. contained the symbol. And I'll send you the symbol once we get to like pictures and all that.
Mm-hmm.
However, not even 3 years after the death of Yaroslav, Sviatoslav's younger brother, Vyacheslav of Smolensk, passed away. The Yaroslavichi took their brother's land and added it to the Kievan territory, removing the chance of inheriting it from Vyacheslav's young son. So basically, they took out a whole chain of people from being able to claim the Kievan throne. Then they did the exact same thing with the territory of Pskov, which was controlled by their uncle, Sudislav, who, if you remember, was locked up in prison by Yaroslav and then sent to a monastery by the Yaroslavichi, which we did in Izyaslav's episode. And then the territory of Pskov was added to the territories of Novgorod. So basically, they just combined two princedoms into one.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and then there's another very timely death, also in Smolensk, because another brother who wasn't part of the triumvirate, Igor, passed away.
Mm-hmm. And Igor was not a Yaroslavichi.
He was a Yaroslavichi, technically.
He just wasn't in the club at the cool kids table.
He wasn't part of the three elder brothers. So they were like, nope, you're not in. And then he had a sudden case of death when he was visiting Smolensk as well. And lo and behold, all of his territory went to Kiev. And all his sons were removed from inheritance from that territory.
Wow. How strange.
How very strange. And the fun thing is that all of these deaths occurred within a few years of the triumvirate acceding to the thrones of Kiev, Chernigov, and Pereyaslavl. So you see these three brothers are kind of making moves here. Mm-hmm. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to send you a map of the principalities of Kiev. Just because I want you to see where this is. So it'll be on Discord.
Okay.
But if you look at that, it'll show you like where everything is. So like what you see Novgorod as now, that is what they did after they added Pskov to the territory. And then Smolensk, which was right below the gray in the middle, below Novgorod, which is in the north, was added to Kiev. Mm. Then Polotsk, which is where Sviatoslav is in the pink, Yeah. You know, that's independent, like, fully. But you see Chernihiv, Pereyaslavl, and Kyiv are in, like, the south area of Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Principality of Kyiv. Did you say Polons?
Polotsk is for Siestla the Sorcerer.
There's, okay, I see. There's the city of Kyiv, and there's the Principality of Kyiv. I see.
Yes. Yes, and then you see Chernihiv is pretty close to Kyiv, and Pereyaslavl is pretty close to Kyiv. So basically, they're within a few days' ride from each other. So they're able to, you know, plan and do everything accordingly as how they wish. And the whole reason I'm mentioning this is because in this episode, and as we've seen in other episodes, we have been dealing with the Izgoi, which is the Russian term for the princes who were the sons of the Grand Prince of Kyiv, but they didn't get a chance to inherit or have claims due to the unfortunate event that their fathers passed away before the Grand Prince of Kyiv died, you know, who was their grandfathers.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially, their dads predeceased their grandpa, and that's why they can't inherit.
Well, I see no potential for conflict.
Absolutely not. And, you know, there's no potential for conflict here until we remember about this young man named Rostislav. Because you see, Rostislav is the son of Vladimir Yaroslavich, who was the original heir to Kyiv, to Yaroslav the Wise, before he died from a sickness a year or two before Yaroslav the Wise died.
Mm-hmm.
However, we see something funky here, because Yaroslav never gave Novgorod to anybody else after Vladimir died, which leads us to assume that Rostislav was meant to be the assumed heir to Novgorod. So he wanted to keep Novgorod in his son's family, and he recognized that right of succession, and he ruled the land until Rostislav would be able to reach an age where he could rule on his own. But of course, Yaroslav's death changed that.
Right.
And then, as we remember, Izyaslav took control, and he placed a burgomeister, or a posadnik, as we call it in Russian, to administer the town for Rostislav, because Rostislav was still quite young at this point. He couldn't do it on his own. However, Rostislav kept finding himself with less and less and less power the longer the posadnik was there, ruling on his behalf. And then at one point, Izyaslav ousted Rostislav from the territory and puts his own son, Mstislav, in charge. There's going to be a lot of names ending in Slav today.
Yeah.
Now that Rostislav had lost Novgorod, he was fearing for his life because he was a claimant to Novgorod and Izyaslav would be out to kill him. So what he did is he gathered a few of his loyal men and went down to Tumotorokhan, which, due to its distance from Kyiv and the other big city centers in Kyiv and Rus, was a great place for most of the Izgoi to flee to. It's even rumored, as we mentioned last episode, that he was taken there in a single night with the help of Siestlav the Sorcerer.
Ooh. Ooh.
And with Rostislav going down south, it's around this time that some steppe tribes cross into Rus territories.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah.
Perfect timing.
Perfect timing, because this caused a distraction for the triumvirate. So Izyaslav, Sviatoslav, and Sievolod made their way out with their armies to fight off the steppe tribes, which they dispatched rather easily. So it was a pretty easy battle.
Interesting. Because my understanding was that typically their style of fighting was a little more difficult to deal with because it was sort of hit-and-run tactics with horses and archery.
Well, it's at this point where the steppe tribe that came in was actually running around away from the steppe tribe we are going to see coming up soon. You know, the Cumans, we've covered them twice already. These steppe tribes were running away from the Cumans, which is why they were pretty easily dispatched, because they were already pretty weakened.
Okay.
Well, with this distraction of the steppe tribes for Sviatoslav, Rostislav, his nephew, made his way down to Tumotorokhan officially with his actual army, and used his uncle's not being nearby to his advantage. And he put an armed force against Tumotorokhan and seized the city from his cousin, Gleb Sviatoslavich. Gleb returned to Chernihiv, which is his dad's capital, with his tail tucked between his legs, and Rostislav started getting comfortable with ruling Tumotorokhan. Now, how do you think Sviatoslav would react to this?
React to...
his son being kicked out of the city by his nephew.
For what?
He's ousted from the city. So Gleb was taken out of the city he was ruling by his cousin, Rostislav. And he's the eldest son to Sviatoslav.
Yeah.
How would Sviatoslav react to this? What do you think?
I think he would attack the city.
Well, you're all right, because Gleb, of course, told his papa, "Hey, papa, my cousin took my city away from him, from me. Can you can you get it back for me?"
Dad! Oh, dad! Daddy! What's his cousin's name? Is it...
Rostislav.
Oh, papa! Cousin Rostislav took away my lolly. Oh, I'm wearing a little sailor suit and I took away my lolly.
You know, Sviatoslav, you know, grew enraged at this because this is his territory. Things should be peaceful because it's his area. And he gathered up his troops and marched right to Tumatorikon. Rostislav peeked over the city walls and was like, "Oh, okay. I know what we're going to do today, guys." And especially when he saw that this was a much larger force than what he could handle. So he did the one thing and only thing that he could do in this grave situation.
Run away.
He ran away.
Bravely ran away.
He had a strategic retreat. So Rostislav had a strategic retreat and withdrew from the city. Gleb was given back to Motorikon, and Sviatoslav stayed there relaxing for a few days, you know, enjoying the beachside. And then was like, "All right, I'm done. I want to go home." And he left for the city, content with the fact that his son was back in power with no bloodshed. Not even a few weeks after Sviatoslav's departure, Rostislav returned with his men and attacked Tumatorikon again. How do you think this went for him?
You know what? That's a tough one, I have to say. You're saying Rostislav.
Rostislav.
The Sviatoslav? What?
Rostislav.
Rostislav, okay. Rostislav, who had just run away.
He is now attacking Tumatorikon, which is being held by Gleb, and Sviatoslav is gone.
Well, with Sviatoslav gone, I guess it would have gone better for Rostislav.
Yes, because he took the city back again.
Mm-hmm.
So, this caused Gleb to come back to Chernigov once more, and he goes, "Papa! Papa! Cousin Rostislav took my city again!" And Sviatoslav ignored him this time.
Wow, what a great dad.
Well, the reason being...
I wish it was in the room at the time.
Well, the reason being is because Sviatoslav the Sorcerer, at the exact same time, like they coordinated this or something, was causing trouble up north in Novgorod. And this is when we mentioned last time that Sviatoslav took the city of Novgorod from Izyaslav's son, Mstislav. So Sviatoslav was a bit busy marching up north to help his brothers out with gaining probably one of the most profitable cities in Kiev and Rus. Yeah, so... do you want me to go over this for a third time, or can I do the Spark Notes version?
No. Spark Notes, please.
Okay, because that's what I wrote. I knew you'd want the Spark Notes. Sviatoslav, of course, took the city of Novgorod, and along with his brothers, Sviatoslav marched north to capture him. They fought a battle. Sviatoslav lost, but he disappeared in the cover of the night after the battle finished. The Triumvirate, or the Yaroslavichi, said that they wanted a truce with Sviatoslav, and to prove their honesty, they kissed a cross. And Sviatoslav was like, "Alrighty, I believe you guys. I'm a pious man. You're a pious man. I'll believe you." So he came with his two sons. He got arrested and shipped off to Kiev. And luckily, this is going to be the second to last time we will repeat this whole situation. Because we have one more ruler after this named Sviatoslav. Well, and of course, as the chroniclers love to mention, because they broke a promise that they made upon a cross, God then punished the Yaroslavichi by sending a stronger steppe tribe against them, the Cumans. Bam, bam, bam.
It's always interesting to me how Christian chroniclers are really good. Christians in the West, well, Westerners really, always identify these steppe tribes as being the scourge of God or the punishment from God, because Attila the Hun was also called the scourge of God.
Oh yeah.
And it's, you know, it's always like it was outside invaders, barbarians that caused the downfall of the Roman Empire, not like all the other problems. It was always somebody on the outside's fault.
Unless you're Gibbon and you're like, no, it was Christianity's fault.
Oh yeah, true. We can't forget the obvious answer.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Not like there was a Christian Roman Empire for another 1,000 years. Huh.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Cumans strode in and began attacking the Rus, pillaging everything in their sight. Sviatoslav and his brothers combined their forces to attack the menace, but they were ultimately repelled by the raiders. Izyaslav and Svyavolod returned to Kiev to lick their wounds, but Sviatoslav returned to Chernigov, which was closer to the battle site. It's around this time where we see the trouble brewing in Kiev, which we mentioned with Izyaslav and Sviatoslav. And we're going to mention it again with Svyavolod because he was there. But we're going to deal with Sviatoslav because this is his episode, thankfully. Because, if you recall, Izyaslav didn't want to deal with the Cuman threat. He was like, nope, our men are gone. They're almost dead. We can't fight them. Sviatoslav, on the other hand, decided that he had to ensure that they did not harm his princedom and his territory. So he gave his men a few weeks to recuperate and gather as many as he could together. And he only had $3,000. He only had 3,000 soldiers left in his territory, especially after the slaughter that he had faced against the Cumans. So his forces were depleted, but he still wanted to fight. So he took his men and marched towards the Snov River, which is east of Chernigov, and was where the Cumans were camping. Under the cover of the night, he sallied forth to meet them. And Sviatoslav himself was in the vanguard, ready to fight on the front lines, and to fight alongside his men. The Cuban force numbered 12,000 compared to their 3,000, but they didn't anticipate that Sviatoslav would attack them so suddenly, because out of nowhere, the Chernigovan forces just stampeded through their camp, starting to slaughter as many as they could. And the Cumans were, as I said, were caught pretty unawares, and they were unprepared for battle, and they tried to cross the river. Of course, the river current was pretty strong, and many of the horses and the Cumans drowned, while Sviatoslav captured the Cuman tribal leader and returned with him to Chernigov victorious. So he did what his brother wouldn't do. And it's around this time where we see Izyaslav being ousted from Kiev, and Sviatoslav is now ruling the city. Just to give you a time reference as to when this happens. So things are looking up Sviatoslav right now. And news of the Cuman defeat spread through the territory, because we see that with Sviatoslav's approval, Sviatoslav was able to send his son Gleb north to Novgorod and appoint him as the prince of Novgorod, since the Novgorodians did not want Sviatoslav controlling them and would only take a descendant of Yaroslav to be their prince. And thanks to Sviatoslav's victory over the Cumans, the Novgorodians decided that, you know, he would be the best person to appoint a ruler for them than any of the other brothers, because Izyaslav and Svyavolod fled back to their city, to Kiev, and did nothing, while Sviatoslav actually went back and fought.
What do they have against tactical retreats?
Well, they decided to not do any fights afterwards, and they were like, they're in our lands, they're killing us. Do something, anything, please. And Izyaslav was like,
not my problem.
Yeah, that's literally Izyaslav's response. Sviatoslav was like, this is my problem because they're in my territory. With the control of Novgorod under, you know, with Gleb, Sviatoslav was now technically the biggest landholder in Rus. Because if you see our little map here, which I will post on our website, he now owns Chernigov and Novgorod. Wow. Izyaslav just owns, Sviatoslav at the time only owns Kiev and Polotsk. So, so he's, you know, he owns a lot of territory right now. And technically, due to his positioning in Chernigov, he has a pretty good access to the river, to the Black Sea, which would help him control trade a lot more. Yeah. So this is a fun point, because he now controls the northern part of the incoming trade from the Baltic Sea, and controls a pretty good part of the trade coming up from the Black Sea. So it's
nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Oh yeah. However, we see another threat coming from the west, because Izyaslav, who was recently ousted from power by his own citizens, mind you, returned with a Polish army at his side and was marching on Kyiv to fight against Izyaslav.
When in doubt, go to Poland, get yourself an army, come back.
It worked for Swiatopolk, right?
Yeah. There a lot of people have fled to Poland at this rate.
Yeah.
It seems.
Yeah, literally a few Swiatopolk and then Izyaslav. Well, News reached via messenger from Kyiv to Sviatoslav that Izyaslav had used the chaos to teleport himself home and leaving the city to be punished by Izyaslav, because Izyaslav was hella pissed.
Why?
Because they took him out.
What is he going to do to the people who live there?
Kill them.
Okay. You know, that's the same justification Osama bin Laden used for 9/11. I just want to point that out.
Well, that was literally Izyaslav's thinking. He was not a very smart person. So,
yeah, I can understand why someone would think that.
Yeah. So Sviatoslav decided to respond to the messenger and with this message saying, "We shall communicate with our brother. If he marches upon you with the Poles to destroy you, we shall fight against him and not allow him to destroy our father's city. If his intentions are peaceful, then he shall approach with a small troop." End quote. So basically, he was reassuring the Kievans that, hey, if he attacks you, we're going to attack him. We've got your back. So he's ingratiating himself to the Kievans at a pretty early point. These messengers returned to Kyiv and gave them the news. And then Izyaslav heard a letter from his actual brother saying, hey, if you attack our dad's city, we're going to attack you because you're being a jerk. So, and then Sviatoslav, you know, was kind of, well, he was kind of a follower. So he would just kind of do whatever Izyaslav or Sviatoslav told him. At this point, Sviatoslav was closer. So he was going to listen to Sviatoslav. And with both of his brothers against him, Izyaslav knew that he couldn't deal in a war, especially with just a Polish troop that was borrowed. Because guess what the Duke of Poland didn't want to do? Fight against his father-in-law.
Yeah. Yeah, understandable. Yeah.
And then the rest of the message also made Izyaslav aware that Kyiv was offering no real opposition and that he should not attack the people. As we covered in Izyaslav's episode, we know he sent his son in to punish the leaders of the uprising. So he still did some damage, but not to the city directly. So there was no siege, there was no assaulting the walls or anything. It was just, all right, just kill the people who started this whole mess and we're golden.
Sounds like a good plan.
It is. And we have Sviatoslav to thank for calming his brother down.
Ah, the diplomat.
So with Izyaslav now back in control of Kyiv, things became rather quiet for the brothers. I mean, there was a few things here and there that happened, but for Sviatoslav, he ruled from Chernihiv rather peacefully until Sviatoslav attempted to attack Novgorod to take it from his son, Gleb. Gleb's track record is having lost the city twice. So how do you think he did the third time?
I think he lost again. Actually, no, wait. Third time's a charm. Why not?
And that is exactly what Gleb probably thought. Third time's a charm. And he actually repelled Sviatoslav back, keeping control over Novgorod. Right. Great job, Gleb. You're doing great.
Wow. You've really grown. And, you know, we're all so proud of you.
Very much. Now, you want to hear the kind of the smarmy part here? If I'm using that word correctly. It's hinted in the Chronicles that it was, at this point,
Vysyaslav the Sorcerer helped.
Well, no. That Vysyaslav the Sorcerer was the one attacking Novgorod, but he may have been doing it under Izyaslav's orders.
Whoa.
Because Izyaslav at this time controlled Polotsk. And if he may have told Vysyaslav, hey, if you take Novgorod from my nephew, I'll give you Polotsk back. And I get Novgorod, and then we can be in peace. But of course, this didn't happen. So, that we don't know if that's official, but that's very much hinted in the Chronicles, because I did get a new book that gives me more information about this stuff, and I'm very happy with it.
Nice.
Yes. Well, with Gleb now in Novgorod, Sviatoslav removed the Rostislav from Timoturakan, so his nephew's now gone, and he placed his son, Roman, in charge of the city. And then just to kind of show how peaceful things are, and, you know, Sviatoslav's battle prowess, we see new tribes of Cumans making their way through Sviatoslav's land, but every time Sviatoslav goes to fight them, they avoid all of his territories and cities, and do not... They raid everybody else, but they go into Sviatoslav's area, and they're like, nope, do not touch this man. He is fearsome. So it's probably, you know, they're probably afraid of his, you know, killing them all, or because they may have had some treaties in place after they captured one of the tribal leaders. But because they are a tribe, you know, you make a treaty with one tribe, you're not making treaties with all the tribes, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, this isn't Rome or, you know, or America where it's like, oh, you guys are all the same people. No, there's different tribes. So it's a, but word spread around and they're like, do not mess with Sviatoslav. So things are pretty quiet. And around 1072, we're going to mention this again. We've done it before. So the triumvirate decided to show their brotherly love, and together they moved the relics of St. Boris and Gleb to the church in Vyshgorod after they were able to have built a new one for them. On May 2nd, my birthday, not the year though, the Yaroslavichi came down to Vyshgorod by placing the wooden coffin of Boris on their shoulders and following the clergy in procession. When they placed the coffin to its final resting place, they opened the casket and they exhumed the sweet fragrance.
Mm-hmm. Because Boris was such a holy man.
Absolutely. And then they brought Gleb's coffin in on a sled because, you know, Gleb was buried already in a stone coffin. So this is Boris and Gleb, not Gleb Sviatoslavich. But when they got to the entrance of the church, the coffin wouldn't move anymore. Like the sled wouldn't budge. Nothing would work. Until everyone exclaimed, Kyrie eleison, God have mercy.
Oh, I thought you were about to say, well, just put some sawdust under the sled. That usually gets me out of sticky situations. Well, actually, the opposite of sticky situations, literally, slippery situations. Always bring kitty litter with you whenever you're driving in the winter.
Well, once inside with both relics of the saints there, the Metropolitan came in and took out St. Gleb's hand and touched the sores on Sviatoslav's body. Sviatoslav exclaimed with relief at his pain being relieved, and because he had begun to become afflicted with several sores around his body. With this translation of relics over, the princes and their boyars had a great feast. So, it's a Russian party. And they decided, you know, hey bros, you know, we're all together. Why don't we update some of Dad's laws? You know, make some changes, you know, for the better. And they were like, all right, you know, here's the Ruskaya Pravda, or the Russian law codes. And they're like, you know, they agreed on one law. Just one. Can you guess what the law was?
Honestly, I don't know. I'm not going to try on this one.
No, that's okay. Because, so the law that they added was prohibiting people from avenging a murder with another murder.
I think Albania could use that right now.
Well, they didn't, you know, they prohibited avenging murder with another murder. And instead, you had to pay a fee to the person who died, or to the living family. They brought back the Wergild.
Yeah, yeah, the Wergild, the blood money. That's a very old practice in Norse society.
They brought it back. After their grandpa took it away, they brought it back. Huh.
Yeah. It's like the war on drugs. It's like if you outlaw something, you're just going to make everything worse.
Well, a year passed, and Sviatoslav found himself with more and more sores, and he was beginning to cough a bit here and there. He called up his brother Sviatoslav, the prince of Pereyaslavl, and in secret claimed to his brother, hey, I think Izyaslav and Sviatoslav had made amends and formed the pact, and they might be trying to take away our lands to give it to Izyaslav. For, you know, so Sviatoslav can be independent again. And according to the chroniclers, Sviatoslav may have been lying to his brother.
Interesting.
Because if anything was true, it may be that Izyaslav and Sviatoslav may have actually been working together to take out the largest landowner in the region, Who's the largest landowner in the region right now, Brendan?
The largest landowner in the region? Sviatoslav.
It is Sviatoslav. And why would the Grand Prince want to remove his biggest landowner?
Because he wants his land.
Exactly. He wanted Novgorod back. That was the main reason.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, another a few reasons that Sviatoslav may have was, you know, Yaroslav was just a really poor military leader. And he really couldn't fight his battles himself. You know, he always had to get Sviatoslav to assist him every time. It was Sviatoslav who always led their forces to victory. And the Kievans were still kind of annoyed of Yaroslav. They didn't welcome him back with open arms. And it was highly likely that the Kievans may have come up to Sviatoslav before and been like, "Hey, Prince, can you like take out this guy? Because he's really bad. Why do we keep him? And he always runs away from stuff. Like, please." Sviatoslav and Sviatoslav approached Yaroslav in Kiev and essentially said, "Hey, we're allying together. Get off the throne right now, or we're going to make you get off the throne." And it's at this point that Sviatoslav sat down on the throne and became the Grand Prince of Kiev after Yaroslav ran with his tail between his legs back to Poland after taking a bunch of treasure with him. So Sviatoslav is now the Grand Prince after a very bloodless coup. I like this guy. He's, you know...
Yeah, I think he's quite cool.
Now, here's some other thing. The Kievans may have sent a prominent boyar named Jan Vyshatych, who at this point was known for his wisdom and piety and was a very well-liked boyar. So he was representing most of the nobles in Kiev. And we think that he may have been the person who said to Sviatoslav, "Hey, be the Grand Prince," because he was made a lieutenant in Rostov, which is way up in the northeast, because he was making everyone aware that, hey, Yaroslav's rule was a huge issue for everybody. And Yaroslav's just a really shady guy because he was talking to the abbot of the Monastery of the Caves about how Yaroslav was kind of trying to attempt to remove the lands of all his brothers. So, like, he was talking to the... Yaroslav was talking to the clergy about, "Hey, I want to take these people's land. How do I do it best and legally? And, you know, under God's purview." So, and the Kievans heard about this and was like, "Wait, no, Sviatoslav's a good guy. He saved us from the Cumans. He made sure that you didn't kill us all. Like, why are you trying to screw him over?" It was pretty much worthwhile for Sviatoslav to be the prince at this point, because if his brother's good for nothing, why would he not be the one in charge, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm following.
Yeah. And then the best part about this is, because Sviatoslav is now the Grand Prince, what happens with his sons? What do they get out of all of this?
That's a good question. I don't know.
What is the one thing that...
Land.
We mentioned before... No, not land. What is the one thing we mentioned before about sons?
Inheritance.
Inheritance. What? Yeah.
So land. What,
yeah, but what land does his eldest son have a right to get now?
So Sviatoslav has Kiev. He has Novgorod. Excuse me. He has Novgorod. Right?
Yes.
So his sons will have Novgorod and Kiev.
Yes. They now have a claim. All of his sons now have a claim to Kiev.
Yeah, actually, let me remedy that quickly. His sons have a claim to split up Kiev and then fight over it for the rest of their lives.
Yes, that's even better. as the Grand Prince of Kiev, he decided to embark on quite a few projects. He had a lot of money from controlling most of the trade in Rus, because he owned most of the river paths. So... he was able to build a new church to the Mother of God in Kiev, and he patronized a collection of religious works so that they could be made available in one place. So instead of having a bunch of like extant works all over, he was like, "Nope, let's put a collection out of all of these in one place so we can read them in one place." And, you know, I do want to remind everyone that, hey, books were handwritten at this time, so this would be a huge amount of manpower to collect all the documents and put them into one book, especially if you're going to make copies of them. So,
well, that's what monks are for.
Exactly. So he had the monks do this for him, but he basically said, "Hey, do this so we can have it on one place," because he liked the learning a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then Sviatoslav found out that, hey, Yaroslav was going to Poland to get more support, because the Duke of Poland is his brother-in-law. So he decided, hey, let me send a message to my son-in-law, who I have more purview as a father over, and ask Duke Boleslav II of Poland to expel Izyaslav and not give him any aid, but also to figure out a way to take all his money away from him, which he did. So basically, Duke Boleslav II, as we mentioned in Izyaslav's episode, promised Izyaslav, hey, yeah, I'll help you, give me payment. And then he never helped him and never gave him back his money. And then a messenger from the Holy Roman Emperor, Henry IV, who at this time was just King of Germany, arrived to Kyiv and was wondering, you know, what's going on with Izyaslav? Why is he saying that he's the Grand Prince and wants an army to help, you know, help him and everything? And, you know, Sviatoslav was like, hey, let me give you the right deets here. I'm the Grand Prince. Izyaslav's just a sore loser who lost his throne twice. So, like, he doesn't need to have it. And look at all this money that I can just give to you and to your king. Take this and just ignore Izyaslav. So he basically let the messenger go back with a bunch of money and gifts, and after showcasing how wealthy he was. And so at this point, Izyaslav was not given any aid by the Poles or the Germans and was kind of losing a lot of money, and he goes down to the Pope. It was, however, around this time that Sviatoslav decided to do a bit of bloodletting. And he took a knife and cut open one of his sores to help relieve his pain. After a few days, the sore turned blacker and blacker, and his body reached an intense temperature.
This is a medieval medicine moment.
And then the following morning, he was as cold as ice in his bed. Sviatoslav's reign was a rather peaceful one.
Really? You call that peaceful? You call that peaceful?
I mean, he didn't go to war during his reign. Come on.
Yes, he did. He attacked the city on behalf of his son, because his cousin took it away from him.
But no, not as the Grand Duke, not as the Grand Prince of Kyiv.
That still counts.
I know. Well, he took the throne of Kyiv in a bloodless coup, because now his sons were claimants to the Kievan throne. And this is where the mess will begin. How was that for you, Brendan?
Another anticlimactic ending. Although, I have to say, not dying in battle is an accomplishment.
Yeah.
I wouldn't call it dying of old age. What? How old was he at this time?
So he died in 1076, and he was born in 1027.
Okay, so he was in his late 40s. I'm not doing the math right now. It's I'm tired. It's late.
You know what? I'm going to do the math really quick. So 1076 minus 1027. He was 49.
Just subtract 76 from, 49. All right. You know what? That's not bad.
All right. Are you ready to rate him?
Yeah. All right. Let's go.
All right. Let me pull up the spread. Oh, no. What? I closed everything. Okay. Let me pull up the, I closed the list and everything. Let me pull it up really quick. Luckily, to the power of editing, we can do this. All righty.
Hello and bonjour. My name is Josh Zucker, and I want to take you on a journey through some of the most exciting events of the late Middle Ages. Valois Burgundy was one of the medieval world's greatest what-ifs. Its dukes inherited, conquered, and politicked their way into forging a state between the German Empire and the Kingdom of France that rivaled them both. From the Hundred Years' War to the Holy Roman Empire, from urban workers to Joan of Arc, and from gallant knights to gunpowder weapons, the Grand Dukes of the West had a part to play in almost all of Western Europe's biggest developments in the 14th and 15th centuries. If you want to learn more about the glamorous rise and dramatic fall of the Dukes of Burgundy, please join me for Grand Dukes of the West, A History of Valois Burgundy.
Gamarjoba, my name is Roberto, and I would like to sincerely thank you for taking the time to check out my podcast, The History of Sakartvelo, Georgia. In all likelihood, I would venture to guess that you found us because you were searching for either podcasts, YouTube videos, blogs about the history of Georgia, or you're hearing this on another podcast, like this one. I'm both sorry and happy to report that this beautiful and fascinating country is, to my great surprise, criminally underrated in the history world. As of now, this is the only podcast I am aware of dedicated to the full history of a nation and a people that have served as the battleground for empires all throughout European and Asian history. But the land of the Kartveli is so much more than that. The birthplace of wine, the second Christian kingdom, the land of fantastic food, nearly superhuman dancers and musicians, and perhaps, most importantly, a people that have preserved their culture, pride, and independence after centuries of one conquest after another. Empires rise and fall, but Sakartvelo always seems to survive in the end. So, let us celebrate this beautiful land by coming with me on this journey from prehistory to the present day, right here at the History of Sakartvelo, Georgia. You can find us on Twitter at @history_Georgia. Sakartvelo is spelled Sakartvelo. Now back to your regularly scheduled podcast.
Specialna operacja.
Special operations. How well did they do in battle, lead in battle, or have others lead in battle for them? Basically military prowess. So his military campaigns consisted of the one time that he came to the aid of his son after his son was thrown out of was it Novgorod?
Timoturakan.
Yeah, Timotur, that's right. So his son was thrown out of Timoturakan by his cousin, aka Sviatoslav's nephew, and simply showing up was enough for him to turn tail and run. So that's a point for him, I think. He fought the Cumans, I know that, and it appears he won, right?
After the second time. So he lost against the Cumans the first time, but that may have been because Izyaslav was in charge of that army.
Okay, fair enough. What other military actions or campaigns am I missing here?
He fought against Yaslav a few times and won all of those. He beat the Cumans, as we mentioned. When he led the fight, he beat the Cumans. Then he won every battle that he was in, either through people being terrified of him, mm-hmm. or just outright losing, but he won almost all of his campaigns save for the one.
Okay.
Yeah.
So basically 90% of the time he won.
Yeah. And the really cool thing is that he went to fight against a force that beat him with a much smaller force and then kicked their asses.
Yeah. So you know what? I feel like nothing is standing out to me as remarkable that would cause me to give him a 9 or a 10. So I'll give him I'll be conservative and I'll give him a 7.
Yeah, I was thinking about giving him a 6 just cuz mm-hmm. I did like everything that he's done, but he also didn't really expand the realm. He just kind of protected it. Which is mm-hmm. why he's losing points from me. But otherwise, he did a pretty good job. And just protecting. So pretty good. So 6 and 7?
Yeah, I was about to give him an 8, actually. So if you're giving him a 6, yeah, I'll just give him... No, because then we just have to It would... Whatever. No, I'm going with a 7.
Okay. So that's a total of 13 for Specialna Operacja. Uspiech.
Success. How successful were they in running their nation? What cultural significance did they leave behind? So the first thing that comes to mind for me was the fact that he was another book guy. He liked learning, and he compiled a bunch of documents into one copy. Ooh, this is very nice.
I just sent Brendan a picture of a page of the book.
Yeah, this is very beautiful. The illustrations here are very beautiful. So, yeah. As you can imagine, we're both nerds. We're both book guys. These,
mm-hmm.
yeah, it's illustrations of flowers, birds, lions, and just the golden color of the parchment is really, yeah, very nice. And the sort of quilt like mandala part up at the top here. What documents was he gathering here exactly?
Just a bunch of religious documents.
Okay, so the Bible commentaries.
Yeah, stuff like that.
Okay, and it's called the Izbornik?
Izbornik, yeah.
Izbornik.
It's just collection.
It just means collection in Russian?
Yep.
Is it Izbornik Dana?
Izbornik 1073, because that's when it was made. So, like, as soon as he got to the... as soon as he got to the throne, he just started building. He just ordered this done. And it just has like a bunch of like theological compendiums, you know, excerpts of the works of the Church of the Father, a chronology, a survey of poetic figures and tropes, articles on grammar, logic, philosophy, parables, riddles, and a first list of books forbidden in Ukraine.
Ah, interesting. Yeah, I'm looking at the... I just Googled it, and the first thing that came up was something from the Internet Encyclopedia of Ukraine.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking at right now.
Oh, okay. So, yeah. I'll read that later. I like that. That's cool. I like tomes. I'm a tome guy. So I have to give him credit for that, because we're counting cultural success here, or cultural longevity. Ultimately, he died of old age. He did not die in battle. That I consider that quite a success.
He got his sons to be claimants to the throne, despite him not being the eldest son. Even though Izyaslav came back, he can now say according to the rules of his father, or they can say according to the rules of grandpapa, you know, we can now inherit the throne. Because Papa was a grand prince for 3 years. Oh!
mm-hmm. Yeah, so overall I'm feeling pretty good about this one. I want to give him an 8, I think.
I'm going to give him more like a... I'm going to be very different from you here. I'm going to give him a 4.
Yeah?
Yeah, because I don't think he had, like... I love the fact that he had this cultural stuff, but he didn't really have anything of value. And, like, for me, it's, like, 3 points for the book. And then 1 point for... essentially getting his sons to be claimants. But other than that, he really didn't... Actually, I boosted up to a 5 because he did do stuff for Chertigov when he got into the throne too. So...
Okay, that's a good point. I think I'll put it at like a 6.5 now that you've said that.
Okay. So that is... Are you good for your number then?
Yeah, 6.5. I won't do any more subdivisions.
Yeah, that is an 11.5 for Uspiech. Alrighty. Kompromat.
Blackmail. What things did they do behind closed doors, or outwardly, that may have made other people not like them? So this one, the one thing I can think of is kinda telling his son after he got kicked out of Tutaminin?
Tumaturakan.
Timoturakan. So after his son got booted from Timoturakan again, the second time. Okay, granted, you know, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. At this point, it's kind of your fault for losing the city again.
But his son then got Novgorod.
Yeah, well, then his son got Novgorod. That's true. And he did it, and I'm keeping it. Maybe Novgorod just has better defenses. Probably. Just has better defenses. So in terms of, yeah, the only thing I can think of is not really all that much, honestly. Like, I feel like just giving him a 0, honestly.
Okay, I have some stuff here to tell you.
Okay.
Okay, so just remember, he did promise on the cross to not arrest Siaslav, and he did it.
Me, 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 me. Don't care. Do not care.
He usurped Izyaslav from the throne.
Okay. So, again, who cares?
Even though his dad said, follow your elder brother's advice, even though his elder brother was an idiot, he still did it.
All right. Well, yeah, exactly. His elder brother's an idiot.
But he stopped listening to him and took his throne.
Yeah, no, still 0 for me.
He did use his connections to basically like throne block Izyaslav in Western Europe. I thought that was kind of funny in Western Europe. Yeah, because his brother went Poland and Germany.
Okay.
So Central Europe, but it's Western to...
It's west of Russia, is the point. Yeah. Okay, that would bump me up to a one, probably.
And then here's another one. Then I remember reading the Chronicles that when he usurped Izyaslav's throne, the priests and monks from the local monasteries came up to him and was like, no, you need to give the throne back to your brother. This is, you need to be follow, you know, filial love. And he was basically like, okay, here's a bunch of money. Now leave me the F alone.
That's just good politics. It's called diplomacy.
Yes, but I just thought it was kind
of
funny.
It takes two to tango, and the monks also accepted the money.
Yeah. But I thought it was kind of funny, just because I'm going to give him a two.
Yeah, I'm giving him a one.
Okay. So that is a three for kompromat.
Okay.
Okay. Boże mój.
Oh my god. Basically, how good looking were they?
So here's a picture that he had made himself in the Izbornik.
Okay, so this is how he wants to depict himself. Is he in the middle there?
He is in the right hand side of holding the book.
I'm gonna be straight up. He looks like a dead bloated pig.
And this is where I'm going to be very sad to note that, hey, this is the only real picture we have of him that is like contemporary.
Zero.
But I do want to talk, you know, those are his four sons in the background. That is Oda Stade, his new wife, and then that's his young son, Yaroslav, in the bottom. So we have a family picture.
I understand. Yeah, okay, here's the thing. So I understand, like, that not every medieval painting is accurate, but if this is all we have, what I don't even know what is going on with whoever drew this. It's like, okay, just looking at their faces, his wife there, I'm assuming one of her eyes is like halfway up her forehead. None of them have pupils, barely any pupils. He looks like a bloated corpse. He's got fat cheeks. I suppose it's supposed to be his beard. All right, what else do we have here? He looks like a bloated corpse, and his sons look like they're about to starve to death.
Well, here's another picture we have from the Radzivill Chronicles. He's the figure in the middle, and this is him showing his bling to the German messengers.
Okay, so this is way better. Okay, so the artist clearly is way more competent here because he understands the beauty of simplicity. They drew his face here, and it's literally just, you know, zero, almost no detail here. Doesn't even have a beard.
Okay, so this is the first picture I showed you is from the Izbornik, which is how he chose to have himself represented at the time. And this is from the Radzivill Chronicles, which came out over 400 years after he died.
Okay, here's the thing. Aesthetically, I am not all that opposed to the Izbornik. I think overall it's a very beautifully illuminated book. However, if we're judging a person's appearance based on I cannot emphasize enough. You'll see when the audience will vindicate me when they my take on this when they see the picture on the website. So I will give him 1 point out of pity because the artist he hired was clearly incompetent.
I'm going to give him 3 points.
Okay.
He had a picture of him and his family commissioned. Even though it's not the best picture, it is pretty ugly to look at. I will admit that. But the fact that he decided to have a picture of himself, his wife, and his sons commissioned, for me, is just amazing. Because it does show that he cared about his family.
Family man. I suppose. Except when you're busy.
His daughter's not there because she's married already. Or else she wouldn't be in the picture.
So she's not considered part of his family, technically.
Yeah, because she's off of Poland. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
she's useful for Polish connections, but that's about it. So, are you good with your one then?
Yeah, I'm sticking with one.
Okay, I'm sticking with a three, so that is a four for Boże Mój. Okay, Władysława.
Sovereignty. How long did they last on the throne? Well, I know when he was born. 1027? Yeah. And he died in 1054. So he died at the age of 49. 1056.
1054 was Yaroslav. 1076.
I don't care. 1076. Okay. So yeah, he died at the age of 49.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I know how long he lasted still sucking air. But on the throne, I want to say he specifically on the throne as a prince of Kiev.
Yes. Novgorod.
As a prince of Kiev, or Kiev, 15 years.
No, I actually said it earlier. He was prince of Kiev for 3 years.
Oh, because... okay, you did.
Yeah.
I didn't notice.
Yeah, it's okay. Sviatoslav II reigned from March 22nd, 1073 to December 27th, 1076 for a period of 3.75 years or a total of 1.49 points. But, you know, he's been ruling technically territory since 1040.
Yeah.
So
he's been in power of some kind for way longer than that.
Yes. It's just he decided to cut open his sore and infect it and die. Alrighty, I guess this begs the question. Brendan, do you think Sviatoslav is fearsome enough? Do you think he's worthy of being sent off to the gulag or to party it out in the Kremlin?
I'm not going to lie, this was not one of the more entertaining czars, but I just kind of have a strange affection for him. I don't know what it is. I mean, he was a family man. He helped out his sons. He eventually helped one of his sons become a prince of Novgorod. And, you know, he didn't have all that much kompromat. I don't know what it is. He just seems like a good guy. I want to reward his... and he made the Izbornik.
Yeah.
So I kind of feel like he deserves Kremlin.
I was researching this and I'm like, I think he deserves a Kremlin because, like, honestly, for me, the fact that he actually has, you know, did all of these things, and the only reason why anything ever sucked was because of his brother Izyaslav. So the fact that he was able to at least, you know, get his sons to claim on the throne, even though he's going to die. And just for me, it just kind of showed that, you know, he tried to get his family in a better position than it was, because if Izyaslav's family was let to rule, things would just be worse and worse for them as now like cadet branches. Yeah, so I'm glad he got it. So Sviatoslav II, congrats. You did what your predecessor Sviatoslav I couldn't do and go to the Kremlin. Woo! Woo! And he has a total of 32.99 points, which puts him overall, as of right now, in, drumroll please, ninth place out of 12.
That's quite modest.
Yeah, but like, the issue with him is that, you know, we didn't give him a lot on...
He didn't get a lot on kompromat.
Yeah, he lost out on Boże Mój and kompromat, and like, the fact that we give, you know, 20 points to Władysław, which is something he can't control, you know, doesn't help him out at all. Because, you know, Izyaslav got more points than he did. Well, not anymore. He's
dead.
Yeah.
But he could control Władysław.
Except he decided to cut open his...
Yeah.
He cut open the sword and fucking but...
Okay, yeah, that is his fault.
Yeah, but he is behind Izyaslav I and above Igor. So he's not worse than Igor. Well,
I know that's right. Yeah, I know that's right.
Actually, the new standard currently is he worse than Sviatoslav? Because Sviatoslav is worse than Igor.
Yeah.
So yeah, congrats. Well,
congrats.
And this is now where we regret to inform you that an executive decision has been made and we are cutting poetry from the episodes because I can't go through Pushkin all the time. So, Brendan, are you ready with some recommendations today?
Yes, actually. I was trying to come up with one for today and I stumbled on one the other day. I'm going to recommend a musician by the name of Dolores Catarino. You can find her on Spotify. She only has 91 monthly listeners on Spotify, but I stumbled on her on YouTube. I stumbled on her TED Talk where she discusses her musicianship. She practices what she calls, or composes what she calls, polychromatic music. Poly meaning many, chroma meaning color, of course. And what she was referring to is she is working with microtonal music. So in the 12-tone Western scale, I mean, you've shown, you know, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And in between some of those, there's A sharp / B flat. And there's C sharp / D flat and on and on and on. Well, technically, these are just representing particular frequencies of sound. You could also do something in between C sharp and D. That would be C sharp and a half. Or between C and C sharp would be C half sharp. And this is really interesting because I have been aware of the existence of microtonal music for a very long time, and I have yet to encounter too many musicians who I feel actually do it all that well. Like the psych rock band King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard uses microtonal guitars a lot, and Flying Microtonal Banana, one of their first microtonal albums, is one of my favorite albums of all time. But in all fairness, like, well, their one song, Rattlesnake, it's microtonal, yeah, but it has a bass line that's constantly strumming on the same note, and that really helps keep things grounded. What Dolores Catarino does here is she has this instrument that's just covered with buttons, and each of these buttons represents, like, if, like, there is like C half sharp, C to C sharp, she's like getting a bunch of the notes in between C and C half sharp as well. And she makes the synthesizer music with these really warm, rich, relaxing tones with all these just wonderful overtones because of the wave shapes that she's using. And I don't know what she's doing, but like the chords she makes are just really beautiful and they just wash over you. It's some of the most, basically the first microtonal music that I would describe as being beautiful and relaxing rather than very harsh and energetic. Yeah. Dolores, Catarino, Dolores Catarino. Find her on Spotify, YouTube. You can also watch her TED Talk.
Awesome. I will check it out. We'll put this in the episode description below or on the next slide over. I don't know how your podcast catcher works. So my recommendation is something that I ate that I've been missing forever since I moved up to the north. And that recommendation is, no, I love Scrapple, but like I get it here all the time. No, my recommendation is eating Waffle House.
I've never been to Waffle House.
So the thing about Waffle House is it's not, you know, the best food and it's not like the most healthy food, but it's consistent food. It's no waffles. Matter where you go. It's not waffles. It's everything. But it is consistent food.
Well, it's breakfast 24/7.
Yeah, it's breakfast 24/7. And
stop interrupting.
And it's something that you can keep, you know, you can go to any Waffle House around the U.S. in the South and you still get the exact same thing that you love at the same quality. And I realized, you know, after I went down to Virginia and Maryland for work and I got Waffle House again, and I'm like, wow, this wasn't a long drive, but like I still miss eating this stuff because it was, for me, it's something that I always had after concerts, you know, when I needed to get my voice back or just have like something to eat once we get back from a concert at 11 p.m. And for me, my go-to is always sausage, egg, and cheese grits. You know, eggs are starting to side up, mash them together, put in some sausage. And something I've discovered to do here when I make grits is replace the sausage with scrapple, and it's just as good. But it is, for me, it is a great place to kind of know that, hey, it's going to feel like you're eating at home and it's still pretty cheap. So yeah, and it's going to be open no matter what. So, because you know, if Waffle House closes, you know, things are going to be bad out there. So I would highly recommend just, you know, going to Waffle House and eating some Waffle House and getting some grits there if you like grits. And if you don't know what grits are, I'm just going to tell you, they're delicious. That's all you need to know. It's cornmeal.
I was always told that Waffle House is where you go when it's 3 a.m. and you're still drunk. You're like, you're not waking up. Actually, no, it's great hangover food.
It is great hangover food, which is also what I've used it for before in Texas. So, yeah, so Waffle House is my recommendation. So, Brendan, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at @Foster_writing. As of this episode is recording, for reasons I will not go into, I'm going to go private for a couple weeks. But if I look at your account and you seem cool, I'll let you follow me. I'm also starting a Substack blog where I write about philosophy, literature, art, music, politics, and the intersection of all of those things. It's called Invented Organs. So just go to inventedorgans.substack.com. And I have two posts up at the moment. The first one has to do with the relationship between Renaissance demonology and the work of demonology scholar Armando Maggi, and noise music, as in the works of artists such as Merzbo. Oh, and I also have another one that came out yesterday, which was Friday, March 31st, analyzing The Whale as a work of body horror, and while acknowledging that it does not, it really reinforces stereotypes about fat people being disgusting, it nevertheless, as a work of body horror, if it is a work of body horror, which knowing Aronofsky, I think it is, there's a potential for a politics of emancipation to be drawn out from it.
And all of that will also be available under our publications tab on our website. Because I'll just be linking Brendan's articles to that section. So you can get to that. You can go on our website pretty easily.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, everything's going to be free. I'm never going to put out a subscriber only post. I don't believe in that. So
I can't say that I do. I also believe in that because we have a Patreon for a reason. But but if you notice, I
just have a copy, and you can subscribe for a cent a week if you want. I don't care.
Well, if you want to get more direct contact with the podcast itself or just me, you can feel free to access our website at czarpower.com. Because thanks to listener Zach, we got a whole domain name. Thank you, Zach. It's professional now. It looks so nice. There you can find the show notes, pictures, bibliography, and you can vote on whether you think Sviatoslav 2 deserved the Kremlin or the Gulag. And then you can also let Brendan know as to why Sviatoslav 1 deserves the Kremlin.
Yeah, we got some complaints about that one. But whatever, we can hash that one out in the future on a future episode, in a Patreon episode.
No, the plan is if we have a coin flip, we will have the fans decide on whether they can continue on to see who out of everyone who's in a coin flip.
It has to change the official ranking. I think it'd be a fun exercise to see if you or Ben could persuade me why I'm wrong.
Okay. We can get Ben on for that. Well, You can find us on all of our social media as Zarp at Zarp Power Pod, and Zar is spelled T-S-A-R. Now, if you would like to be like our wonderful dukes, princes, counts, you could also support the show by subscribing to our Patreon and get access to bonus episodes for both Zar Power and the History of Starcraft Battle Georgia. We promise we will put an episode there at some point. It's just that my book on Slavic gods got delayed, and it said it was going to arrive at some point in March, and it's still not here. But we also have an Amazon book wish list, a PayPal, and a Ko-fi. And if you'd like to do something that's free, leave a review on your favorite podcast host or on Apple or on Spotify. We'd like reading your reviews, especially if they're 5-star and great reviews. If they're 1-star, keep your nasty comments to yourself. We don't need them. you can just email us what you think would be nice and want us to change, but don't need to post negativity anywhere. And that's a dosignia tovarishi from me.
And remember, vlushprzdet parazitov.
Goodbye.
See ya.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.